Hi, this is Robert Kurson. I'm the author of Shadow Divers. I'm here with John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, the two divers about whom I write in the book. And we're going to talk about some questions that I've had since finishing the book, things I've wondered about and which have arisen in my mind since completing the book. Let me start with the topic of Bill Nagel. He was a very important figure in the early part of the book, and I know a very important person to both of you. I wonder now, nearly 10 years after his death, if you guys miss Bill Nagel.
This is Richie Kohler. I'd have to say absolutely, Rob. To me, Bill epitomized what I loved about wreck diving. He knew how to party. He had a good time on the boat. And not only that, he embraced the challenges of pushing beyond. He wasn't happy with the mediocre, with the day trips. He was always looking beyond the horizon. As a matter of fact, in the wheelhouse of his boat, he actually had a plaque that said, "Set course for the heart of the sun." And that pretty much wrapped up who he was. And I miss him.
This is John Chatterton. I miss Bill Nagel while he was still alive. I mean, here's a guy who I knew as a diver and had a fantastic relationship with. The disease of alcoholism progressed to the point where the last couple of years he was alive, I could hardly recognize him. Bill would have really appreciated the eventual identification of the U-boat, how difficult it was. This was exactly the kind of thing that Bill Nagel was all about. Richie, when you talk about Bill Nagel and the wheelhouse, he did have "Set Your Course for the Heart of the Sun," which was a line from Pink Floyd, but of course he misspelled
yeah.
Course. It was C-O-A-R-S-E, you know, which...
You touched on something earlier that he did so much want to identify this. Do you recall how every dive he was just hoping that we were going to have the answer? He was literally hanging over the side of the boat waiting for us to get up, and how angry he got whenever we headed back and we were empty-handed.
Everything that Bill Nagel was about in diving is epitomized by what happened with the U-869.
I still can't get over the amount of risk you guys took in pushing toward the solution of this mystery. In hindsight now, do either of you regret any of the risks you took in solving this mystery?
You know, the implication is that we solved this mystery and we quit taking risks, which isn't the case. That's, for me, a huge part of diving. It's the challenge. And challenge somehow, some way, comes down to managing a certain amount of risk. And you definitely arrive at the point where you say, well, I learned something from that. Let me not do that again. And but you also arrive at things where you say, this is really the way to go with this. So it really is about experimenting, trying new things out, developing new techniques, and you're going to find stuff that works really great, and then you're going to find stuff that you want to say, I want to remember this as the textbook, what not to do.
I would say that John was always more apt, and still is more apt, to take a chance, to put his butt on the line, where I take a more pragmatic view. In hindsight, looking backwards, I'd have to say that my dives on air were probably the most dangerous thing that I did on that wreck. Although I would be nervous and my heart would be in my throat making penetrations, I always knew I could close my eyes and literally find my way out. And I held comfort in that belief. I never, ever felt I would be lost. I kept in mind that it was a tube. John has always applied himself to the new technology. How can I do this better? I've always said, this is what's working. It's been working. I'm safe. I'll stay here. I'll let other people take the risks and pave new paths, and then I'll follow in their footsteps.
But that's exactly the point, is that we all kind of work within some sort of comfort zone. It's just that how we set the parameters for that comfort zone is what makes us different.
You know, John, I write about how you were an early adopter of breathing Trimix, the so-called voodoo gas of the time, and how Richie was more conservative and waited a little while before he embraced it. Now, today, I find out, John, that you're using a device called a rebreather to be even more productive in the water, while Richie is refraining from embracing the rebreather. Can you tell me what a rebreather is and why it has been so dangerous? There have been a lot of fatalities with the rebreather lately, haven't there?
Well, sure. A rebreather is a device that recycles your exhaust gases. In other words, instead of exhaling bubbles out into the underwater environment, those gases go back through a closed loop system. In other words, you breathe in and you breathe out, but there's no bubbles coming out of the diver. There are, of course, highly technical automatic versions of rebreathers and very simple, basic manual ones. But typically, either the diver adds or a computer adds small amounts of oxygen to compensate for the oxygen that your body is metabolizing. And somewhere else in the loop, there is a carbon dioxide absorbent that removes the carbon dioxide that your body's creating. And you can consume very small amounts of gas as opposed to the really large amounts of gas in open circuit. So from a logistical perspective, this gives you a huge advantage.
But if a lot of guys are dying using it, why are you using it?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of guys dying on Trimix too. It's the change. It's the road to learning about new technology. So the challenge is definitely there. If you're careless with rebreather technology, it'll kill you in a heartbeat.
I want to interrupt here. You said that a lot of guys diving Trimix. They didn't die because of the Trimix. They died from a diving accident. A lot of the rebreather fatalities were because of an operator or a mechanical error. As you mentioned, and as the listeners probably picked up on, it's a very complicated piece of plumbing. And the more complicated the plumbing, the easier it is to stop it up. When I dive open circuit, that is basic scuba tanks, whatever I put into that tank is what I'm going to breathe. That cannot be said about a rebreather. There are too many variables. There could be diver error. There can be an operator error in regards to what gas you're putting in. Anything stops up that plumbing, you don't know what you're breathing anymore. You can try to monitor it, but as the high rate of fatalities have shown, I don't think all the bugs have been worked out, so I'm still shying away from that technology.
As are a lot of other people, and it reminds me of, like, the villagers gathering in the square with their torches about to burn the heretic.
One of the big surprises in this book is your discovery that written history had been wrong and that written history could be fallible. Does either of you view written history differently now because of this experience?
Absolutely. I find that, especially in regards to U-boat warfare, there's an expert in Germany, and his name is Axel Niesley, and he's actually written a book about rewriting history in regards to the U-boat wars and the disposition of the U-boats. As you made mention in the book, at the end of the war, the assessors really just wanted to go home. And for all those U-boats that were still missing at sea, they just as quickly as possible, willy-nilly, tried to attach a fate to it. So if you take that and then you compound that with all of the merchant vessels that went missing, and we're not just talking about World War II, we're talking about since the 1900s and prior, but I'm referring mostly to steamships and metal-hulled vessels where there'll be some remains on the seafloor. There are literally thousands of wreck sites that are just waiting to be discovered that are unknown. And each discovery will in some way rewrite history. And I think that human nature will always be to try and find the easiest path, the quickest path to make the explanation and move on.
Well, you know, I think the thing that was most enlightening for me about the entire project was that history is a work in progress. The thing that I've maybe come to realize since identifying the submarine is that there are people that really try and control and direct history. Certainly the assessors, as much as they might have wanted to complete their job and go home, they also didn't have all the cards. The governments that belong to the Allied front didn't want them to have the information about the Enigma decrypts. So essentially, history was being manipulated, or the writing of history was certainly being manipulated by the powers of the time. So now, you know, more than half a century later, we're kind of looking at certain aspects of history and seeing them for the first time.
Does either one of you still dive the U-boat wreck? And if not, why not?
I was on the U-boat once since we identified it, and that was to put a wreath on the wreck. And I feel I've done everything there. There's nothing there for me right now. You got to remember, that was like, you know, I wished while we were still working on it, I wished we could identify it so I didn't have to go back there again. So now that we have identified it, I don't have to.
I still make an annual pilgrimage, if you will, to the wreck. It's like an old friend. I usually muck about in the debris field. I'm kind of hoping that one day I can find and photograph the torpedo. And I still like to dive the wreck. It's still a challenging dive. As far as having fun on it and going inside, I don't go inside. I don't look to collect artifacts. I just really appreciate it aesthetically and to search around in the sand.
John, we talked a lot about your experience in Vietnam as a young man, some of which I think was difficult for you to talk about. Was that tough for you to go over that ground? And is it still tough for you to think about those days?
I don't wear Vietnam on my sleeve. There was a time where I thought about Vietnam every day. And, when I passed that time, it's something that I'm kind of glad I don't have to address it every day. It is difficult for me to separate Vietnam from my personal, philosophy on politics. And certainly I think that when I look at where America is today, I do reflect back on not just my experience in Vietnam, but our nation's experience in Vietnam. The experience that I had being interviewed by you was the first time I really sat down and did a lot of talking about it. Difficult, yes, but I think somehow, some way, I survived Vietnam, and I came out of it much better than a lot of guys did. So I'm sure a lot of guys would just kick me in the ass and say, move on, get on with it. So
are there still rivalries between dive boats and dive boat captains? That's one of the things that amazed me the most. And I wonder if those feuds still survive to this day.
Absolutely. Not only are the old ones still glowing brightly, but some new ones pop up. I think in a small community, it's just bound to happen. There are petty rivalries. There are business issues that get challenged, and out with the old and new with the new. As soon as Bill Nagel was dead, I'm positive that Steve Belinda found someone new to turn his ire against. And yes, there are definitely some very, very, very hot issues in the Northeast rec community. I want to add that when I speak to people from all over the world, I find that this is something that only seems to happen here. Although there are some issues in Europe, in England, and there are some issues in California, nothing that matches these blood feuds that are legendary in wreck diving communities that occur here in the Northeast.
I think it's more important that you are feuding as opposed to what you're feuding over. That's secondary, really. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of that still goes on. I don't listen to it much anymore, but I'm sure it's still there. And I know I hear about, this guy's mad at that guy, or Billy put my pigtail in the inkwell, that kind of stuff.
Was either one of you surprised by anything you read about the other in the book?
Reading the book, I got a lot more insight into his heritage and how he perceived his link with other Germans. In his mind, no small thing.
I came away from reading the book thinking to myself, this guy is one heroic son of a bitch. I know John a long time, and I knew he was in Nam. I've watched him work futilely trying to resuscitate Chris Rouse Sr. I watched him with a stethoscope around his neck, monitoring the progress of Lou Cole on the boat after his dirt dart dive. And I knew that he had been a medic in Nam. I knew that he had a medical background, and I could see a guy who could be goofy as heck one second turn so deadly serious about the well-being of another human being. But until I read about his time in Vietnam, about LACO and the things that occurred there. It's not something he ever talked about. And we're talking about a guy who, to my surprise, when he was in a dark part of his life, when his marriage was failing, and he reached out for me in a way that I never thought he would have. You think that sometimes people don't have secrets. Well, that was something about John that I was, I won't say shocked. I wasn't shocked, but I was surprised. Because that obviously had to have a great impact in his life.
Richie, it's always been important to you, not just in terms of your German heritage, to solve this mystery and identify these men and give them their names, but to give closure to the families in Germany of these crewmen. Are you still in touch with the families, or did you just wrap up your business once the diving was done?
Well, I'm going to start back at the beginning. How did this genesis occur? You know, I started diving the boat because I wanted a dish. I wanted an artifact. And what happened was a change that I didn't see it happen. It happened so gradually. But I think that the reason it happened was that although I had been diving for many years on many, many shipwrecks that involved loss of life, never before was that so prevalent. You never see human remains in any other shipwreck. Yet when you go into the inner compartments of the submarine, you cannot avoid them. They are omnipresent. They are everywhere. And this started to have an effect on me. And then I guess somehow, like a shadow in the past, my German heritage started to come in, and I didn't realize it for that, but I felt like I owed these guys something. And once we identified the submarine, we located one person here in the United States, the sister of a crewman. Her name is Barbara Bowling. Her brother, Otto Britzius, was aboard the U-869, and I met with her. And that was the first time I could physically touch someone alive that had a connection to this boat. And with her, we went to Germany and met other family members. And to this day, she's almost 10 years later, I'm still in contact with almost every one of them. I exchange emails with, believe it or not, the great nephews, and in some cases, the children of members of the crew. I personally gave every one of them in my visit a photograph of the memorial, the wreath that we put on there, and the survivor, Herbert Koszewski. I still maintain contact with him as well. And every time, I've actually traveled to Germany three times, and each time I always make it a point to see as many of them as possible. As time goes by, they're not going to be around.
I really admire Richie for the way that he's kept in touch with all of these relatives of the crew members and that kind of thing. I can't even get my Christmas cards mailed out, but he seems to find time to talk to these guys, to email them, to visit them when he's in Germany and that kind of thing. It's a pretty neat deal.
Were there any hard parts for either of you in recounting this story for me as we did our endless hours of interviews?
For me, the only really hard parts were Vietnam was tough. The Rouse thing was tough. The Steve Feldman accident was tough. What do you think, Richie?
The Rouses, I wasn't there for the Feldman, but the Rouses was difficult. But, you know, you build up a callus and you protect yourself. The thing that surprised me more was recounting for you, and I still get a dark feeling inside when I remember the days when my marriage had broken apart and I was separated from my children, and I felt so lost. I was so happy to have left my wife, and I reveled in that newfound freedom. And then just as quickly, like water would fill a vacuum, I was filled with this longing. And I went back into a bad marriage just to fill that. And I realized that what I really missed was my children. They were such an important part of my life every day, every day, every day, that until you take it away, once the vacation goes away and the party dies down, that was the hardest thing.
When we started out with this thing, we kind of thought, oh yeah, we'll do an interview. It'll be really neat. Tell the story of the 869 and all that kind of thing. It really kind of developed like a job. So it was, you had the obligation to do a good job, and we would sit down and go over stuff with Rob, and you know, back and forth and phone calls and, you know, I need to talk to you and that kind of thing. So initially, I don't think I understood how much work it was going to be or how work-like it was going to be. But we also, both of us, I think, had a real, actually, I guess all three of us, had a real interest in making making this a good book.
Rob, you opened up drawers and peered into dark closets that I had long ago closed and walked away from. And although it was uncomfortable, as I tried to say, I think it really added to the book. It put a level of reality that even I was surprised to read. And as I told you, there are some things that are uncomfortable to even read.
Well, you know, but the most interesting thing is the fact that it wasn't just Rob sitting down talking to you and I, and then the perspective from you and I is the book. What was kind of unnerving was that whatever we were talking to Rob about, Rob would then go to other people who were knowledgeable in those events or what was going on and get their input. So the book is not really what I have to say, and the book is not really what Richie has to say, but the book is kind of what really happened. It would be unnerving when Rob would call me up and say, you know, hey, I just talked to the guy who was your battalion surgeon in Vietnam, and he said this. You know, you never mentioned that. It was kind of creepy having him, like, wandering around in knowing he was, you know, we never knew where he was going to pop up in your life.
Yeah, opening those drawers and closets.
Yeah, sure.
Is there anything that's still a mystery to you about the U-boat?
Sure. The sinking of the U-boat is largely supposition. I think you'd have a hard time disputing that it was a T-5 acoustic torpedo that sent it to the bottom. If she fired a T-5 acoustic torpedo at a target, what was that target? So there's still a lot of questions. And largely, I think they're questions that will probably never be answered, but you can't rule out that tomorrow we might find out something new and different.
There's a couple of things that haunt me, and I don't think we'll ever have the answer. The first that comes to mind is that on the upper deck, there was a life raft canister that was partially opened. And if you look at this thing, it had butterfly nuts on it, and you could see that it's not something that could have been wrenched open. To me, it implied that there might have possibly been someone who tried to open it. Not only that, there were other artifacts that were found by John Yerga that were outside on top of the wreck. Flare pistol.
Torpedo detonator.
Exactly. Escape gear, which...
And the damage to the pressure hull back aft at the aft torpedo loading hatch.
All of these things are mysteries. Was the boat on the surface? Did someone get out? Did someone try to launch a life raft? Regardless of what date, it still would have been February 1945, thereabouts. They wouldn't have lived long in the water. Was one guy floating away?
Which is why history is a work in progress. And, you know, maybe some of these things there will be answers to, but the preponderance of them, I doubt that anyone in our lifetime anyway will come up with an answer.
Well, what's going to become of this wreck? Will it last forever, or do wrecks deteriorate, and how fast do they deteriorate?
Everybody knows the story of Titanic and have been amazed by the footage that came back from Dr. Ballard of this somewhat intact bow section sitting on the seafloor, and they're amazed by that, and they think that forever these wrecks will just remain a tomb, but that's not truly the case. The U-boat is a lot shallower and subjected to storms and conditions and higher salinity, and all of that adds up to the fact that the steel hull is rusting at an incredible pace. Not only that, fishing boats inadvertently are still getting their nets and cables on it and are ripping the boat to pieces and dragging off chunks of it. Eventually, it'll be nothing more than a rust stain on the seafloor. All wrecks will be reclaimed. You know, I hate to get all biblical here, but dust to dust, and that's quite the truth. I would say, I don't know, maybe 100, 200 years, there'll probably be nothing left but glass and ceramics.
The wreck has changed significantly over the last decade since we first started diving it. The original drawing that Danny Crowell did of the wreck in 1991 is nothing like the way the wreck looks today. And shipwrecks are just like people. They age. And some age gracefully, some not, you know. If you're talking about wrecks in freshwater environments like the Great Lakes or shipwrecks in the Baltic Sea, that's entirely different. But marine wrecks in the saltwater environment in the northeastern United States, in the western Atlantic, they will age. And eventually there will be little left. They're just like the same way that people age and pass on.
Now, this six-year quest ultimately contributed to the demise of both your marriages. Now you're both remarried. How do your current wives deal with the consuming passion that diving is for you and the danger that's inherent in it?
My wife, Carla, knows that diving is what I do for a living. She's very tolerant. She's very understanding. I think sometimes she kind of bites her lip when she thinks, she was a little nervous when I was going on this most recent cave diving expedition. But for years, I was just telling her that everyone called me Mr. Safety. So when I would go diving, she'd say, you're going to be careful. I'd say, remember, honey, they call me Mr. Safety. But then I think John Yerga was the one who said they don't call him Mr. Safety. They call him Mr. Wacko. And
I'll attest to that. I met my wife, Carrie, actually on a dive boat, on the Seeker of all boats. And we started dating, and part of our dating was to go diving. And when I met her, she was an open water diver. And since that time, she has become an advanced open water diver and to some degrees a technical diver, in the fact that she has made one dive now to the Andrea Doria and multiple dives to a wreck called the Parker, which is in 180 feet, and even made a few dives to the bottom of the Mudhole, a dangerous area that we dive here in the Northeast. And these are all challenging dives, and to her credit, she's done them all on air, which, as you know, Rob, can be quite interesting. She likes the hammer of narcosis, to be honest with you. I think she feels safe. She's diving with me. And I think that definitely contributes to
Richie,
her safety.
You just said, living with you, she likes the hammer of narcosis.
Well, there you go.
I mean, maybe I'm paraphrasing.
So she shares in my adventures and understands that there are some times when she stays at the dock and I'm going to go out and do the deeper stuff that she hasn't reached the level of expertise to go. And she, I think, like Carla, bites her lip a little, because she knows that, you know, you're on the edge. But, well, but she has faith in my ability.
And in every relationship that is true and healthy and positive, you have to take into consideration who the people are. And diving for Richie and I is certainly part of who we are. And you're not going to extract that from us, extract the more dangerous, high-profile, deep, high-tech dives, whatever, and have us be the same people that we are. So it's like you got to kind of love us as we are. And, maybe there are times where that's a little bit difficult. But for me, anyway, luckily, I am married to somebody that is good at letting me be me.
You touched on something, too. My wife has opened up my horizon. She's actually taken me skydiving and taught me how to snow ski. And since that time, we've been to some of the best locations, at least in the Northeast, or I should say in the United States and Canada, skiing some of the most challenging areas. So she does live life to the fullest. And I think that was one of the things that I loved about her the most and made me want to marry her.
Carla took me rollerblading. I hit moving cars.
This was bad.
As well as park cars.
This was bad. I remember.
John, at one point in the book, at the height of your frustration and not being able to solve the mystery, you went out almost in an explosion of creative energy and discovered and or identified four major shipwrecks. Are you still in pursuit of the missing? And if so, can you share with us or clue us into the kind of thing you might be looking for, and for Richie too?
I think, you know, at that time, it was like the guy who was having trouble with his girlfriend and starts dating a whole bunch of other women. I was looking for distractions from the frustration at diving the U-869 and diving on the Carolina, the Texel, the Pan Pennsylvania, all kinds of the Lusitania even. There were a lot of projects that I got involved in that I was very successful with. And of course, that was maybe something I needed, was where I wasn't being successful with the U-boat. I was successful on these other projects. I don't know that there's anything, any hangover stuff from that period that, there's nothing that really still gnaws at me from back then. I think that whole experience has taught me how small the planet is. And there are projects that I have been involved with that weren't successful. One was looking for the wreck of the Struma in the Black Sea. But it's also, I kind of think like, well, you know, maybe the time wasn't right for it when I went there in 2000. So, I certainly haven't forgotten about that, but I don't have the feeling for any shipwreck, like I had with the 869. You got to remember that the 869 too, nobody else was really diving it, researching it, working on it, trying to identify it. The large portion of divers that I knew, that even ones that were visiting the wreck, were resigned to the fact that, like, well, you know, maybe someday some guy will identify the wreck, but, you know, you're not going to make it happen just by pushing, you know, it'll be fate.
Once we identified the U-869, I was contacted by friends who had moved back to England and was invited to form up an American contingent and go and dive on U-boat wrecks in the English Channel in an effort to try and identify them. I mean, we were bemoaning our one U-boat. They've got literally hundreds from World War I and World War II surrounding England. And divers are stumbling over these things all the time. And there was a few that they just could not identify. So I thought that was a great thing that I was asked to do this. And I was also encouraged by some people in Germany to use my expertise. Since that time, I've also applied my energies to finding some of the other boats that John and I thought the U-869 could have been, namely the 857 or the 879. They're out there somewhere. They say one might be in the Gulf of Maine. I've also invested some energy into trying to put together a trip to find the U-215, which is supposedly lost on the George's Banks, which would be quite a challenging technical dive. And to the best of my knowledge, no one has ever actually been out there diving on the George's Banks. Short of that, I've done some other work here close to home. Back in 2000, a dive boat captain located the forward half of an American destroyer, and through some creative work and with the help of a friend, Christina Young, I actually was able to nail the identification of that shipwreck as the USS Murphy, and I'm quite proud of that effort. Other than that, I just keep on diving. I dive with my family. I dive with my wife. My son is going to be starting to dive soon, and I'm looking to do a little of my own work and share some of my passion with my family.
Did your experience on the U-boat change the way you dive now in any way?
I'd say absolutely. I mean, the way that the Atlantic wreck divers took this Florida spearfishing kid and shook him around, my experiences diving with John, I won't say that John did the same thing. There's a big difference. The Atlantic wreck divers said, you'll do this and you'll do this because of this reason. John leads by example. He doesn't try to encourage anybody, just like the rebreather. But, you know, if you rub shoulders with people and you see that they're doing something and it's working better, well, then you'd be a fool not to change, as long as he doesn't kill himself. So during the course of our work on the U-boat, I changed almost everything about the way I dive, short of the dry suit and the mask and fins, but basically everything from the way that my tanks were strapped to my body, the regulators that I breathed out, what I was breathing, the size of tanks that I was carrying changed. I mean, that's one little thing, but it all adds up. At the time, I was diving double aluminum 80s, which gave me a bottom gas capacity of about 160 cubic feet of gas. When I changed to these larger capacity tanks, it gave me 240 cubic feet of gas to have on the bottom. I mean, that's a major difference and a big safety factor. I would have to say that not only did I change equipment, I changed breathing medium, and I changed technique.
I think everything changes.
Yes.
The equipment changes, but you know, that's like a snapshot. The thing that evolves too is your philosophy, your approach. And I think the U-boat was all about being open to new ideas and new techniques and understanding that, time marches on and understanding the concept of progress is what will make you successful and productive in the water. So my experience on the U-boat really reinforced my philosophy of being open to new ideas.
I got a personal motto that I'd like to share with you, which during the course of our research, I got to meet many German U-boat commanders in their home. And one of them was an ace. His name is Eric Topp. And he was one of the most highly decorated German U-boat commanders of the war. And in getting to know him, I did some research about him, and I have a translation of a comment that he made, a quote actually, from 1943 when he was in his heyday, when he was one of the most lauded U-boat commanders in Germany. And that quote was that life is a matter of luck. And the odds in favor of success are in no way enhanced by extreme caution. And that stayed with me throughout this entire time. And I still think that in some degree that's a great way to live your life.
This is Michael Pritchard. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Shadow Divers by Robert Kirsten. Shadow Divers, the true adventure of two Americans who risked everything to solve one of the last mysteries of World War II. Copyright 2004 by Robert Kirsten and U869 Partnership. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Production copyright 2004, books on tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.